Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. Now, joining me this week on the podcast is Hector Nuns, one of Snooker's leading journalists and the author of a brand new book, The Crucible's Greatest Matches. This is a rundown of 20 classic matches held at the Crucible. Of course, this year it's the 40th anniversary of the World Championship being staged at the famous Sheffield Theatre. And Hector's done a great job with this book. He's spoken to so many people who are involved in the matches themselves. So he's got interviews with the likes of Steve Davis, Stephen Hendry, Ronnie O'Sullivan, many others as well, Sean Murphy, Peter Ebdon, Ken Doherty. The list really does go on and on of legends of the game, plus some of the runners-up, Jimmy White, Matthew Stevens, talking about the near misses. And what's great about that is it puts all the matches into historical context. It's not just a rundown of the breaks and the run of play within the matches. It's actually hearing contemporary recollections of what happened. It's an absolutely fascinating book. I think snooker fans will really enjoy it, particularly, of course, at this time of year. It's published by Pitch Publishing. It's out on April the 14th, so the day before the World Championship itself. And Hector will be taking plenty of copies to the Crucible. They'll be on sale there at the merchandise stand. And, of course, you can get them online as well. So I hope you enjoy the chat. This is the Snooker Scene podcast with Hector Nuns. Well, Hector, congratulations on the book. Before we get to it, just chat about your sort of introduction to snooker. You do actually talk about this in the introduction to the book, but how did you sort of discover the sport?
Yeah, well, as you say, it's a bit of a lengthy preamble in the book, where I do go a little bit into sort of how I sort of fell in love with the sport and also got into journalism. I think with snooker, I was probably a typical kid. Had a 6x3 table when I was, I don't know, 12 or 13 at home. Used to play with my brothers. Loved the sport, and sort of got a bit older. I was obviously watching it on TV, all the big tournaments on the BBC. And we got to school. We started being able to sort of get out of school a bit, you know, when you were 16. Started going down to a snooker club in Lancing in Sussex, which is just a short distance from Stenning, where I was at school. And always liked it. I just loved it. First got shown a table by my uncle, probably when I was about 9 or 10. It was at Effingham Golf Club in Surrey. And I just thought it was just a really cool game. It was incredibly difficult to play, but I think, as I say in the book, endless possibilities. And always loved it from then.
So that's just true of a lot of people of your age. But you ended up in the position of writing about it. So how did that happen? How did you end up becoming a sort of regular on the circuit?
Well, I think I got into journalism sort of fairly late. So I'd done some other things, didn't really know what I wanted to do after college, and tried some other jobs for varying degrees of success or otherwise. And I think I got to a bit of a road to Damascus moment when I was about 30, 31, where you go into these sort of training seminars sometimes in more formal jobs, in office-based jobs, and they ask you, what was your dream job? You know, what would you have done? And I kept on saying, I would like to have been a sports journalist. And I just thought, well, really, you should give this a go, shouldn't you? You can't go through your whole life saying, that's what I would have liked to have done. You know, I saw what other people were writing. I thought, you know, particularly the two sports that I liked the most, which was football and snooker, I thought I could do as well or better. But it's time to put, you can't just say that, you have to put it to the test. So So I started writing a column for my local paper, the West Sussex County Times, about the fortunes of Brighton and Hove Albion, which at that time were very, very low. They were down in the fourth division. But it was a lot of fun to do, and I went and did a course, and then started picking up some sub-editing shifts at the Racing Post and the Daily Express and the Evening Standard initially, and then eventually got offered a job at the Evening Standard as a at the Daily Express as a sub-editor, and then from there there was a guy who was the super correspondent, a bloke called John Tex Hennessy, who I know
a legend of
snooker journalism. Yeah. And we used to, I think I was the only other person on the desk who really liked snooker, so we used to sort of chat over a late shift until midnight over various sort of snooker nostalgia and stories and history, matches, that sort of thing. And then when he left, he pretty much threw the Crucible accreditation form over the desk at me and said, there you go, I think you're the only person who in the office who might be able to make some use of that, and take it away and see what you can do this year. And from that moment, the Daily Express started giving me a little bit of freedom to go and cover the big tournaments, and I got to go and cover the World Championship and the Masters and the UK as well. And that's really how it sort of started, actually getting into the professional covering it side of it, rather than just being a watcher.
And what was it like sort of suddenly walking into the Crucible press room?
I think the first time, I do remember, because it was, I think the first time I went up there was also the first year Darren Lewis from The Mirror was up there, so at least there were two of us who were sort of newbies and rookies that year. And it's quite intimidating. I mean, some people that you read a lot, you've listened to, you know, obviously it was your Clive Evertons and yourself, you were up there, Phil Yates, obviously, people that you knew very well, John Dee. There was a great group of sort of journalists, and I think those were the days where every paper had their dedicated snooker correspondent, and which actually made it more fun, because there were more people. And I mean, nowadays you know yourself, I mean, there's sort of myself, maybe Neil Goulding, there's really a lot of the papers only send somebody up for the final, or perhaps to write one feature colour piece about the genius of Ronnie O'Sullivan or something like that, and they view that as proper coverage of a sport, which I don't, and I'm sure a lot of us wouldn't. But it's a slightly more sort of lonely furrow these days, in the sense that there's two or three people who are writing for papers rather than the pack of 12, 14. But it was a lot of fun. People were great. People like John Doherty, who was writing for the Daily Record, obviously covered all the great Scottish players. They're all very helpful. I'd had a little bit of I'd used my first NUJ card to get myself into the old Wembley Conference Centre, where I think you might have been there that day, although I didn't know you then. Just to sort of get an idea of how it worked, and I think I wrote a piece for the local Sussex paper, the Argus, about Mark Davis. It was a year that he'd got to the Masters. So that was just gave me a bit of an idea. So when I got to the Crucible, it was slightly easier, I think. I really enjoyed it. It was a great tournament. I think I covered the 2003 tournament from the office, which I didn't want to, but I had to. And then the first one I actually went to was the 2004 one. Which is where, obviously, Ronnie O'Sullivan won his second world title and played very well, and there were some great matches.
Yeah, well, speaking of great matches, we'll segue into the book. I mean, the 40th anniversary of the Crucible, was that kind of the catalyst for doing this?
It really was. I think I'd always wanted to do a book. I mean, it's quite a natural progression, I think, for a journalist to write a book. Not every journalist can write good books, and not all books are written by journalists, but it's a fairly natural progression, I think. Something I'd always wanted to do personally. I've probably first started seriously thinking about it about a year ago, when somebody, I had a contact with a publisher who's also the sort of head of media at Brighton, the football club. He and his sister run a good publishing company, and he came to the Crucible. I asked him to sort of come up and have a look, just so he got it, and he did get it. He came and sort of watched a bit of a Judd Trump match last year, and really, really enjoyed it, really got it. I think they were looking to add to their repertoire of sports, and they do a lot of football and cricket and other stuff, but I think they really wanted to do another snooker book. Had one a few years ago. And then it was the hook, that I was thinking 40th anniversary, that's a really good opportunity that won't come around again for a bit, to write a book people might be interested in. And then it was just what to do, and it was just really, it was really clear. I had a real clarity about it, what I wanted to do, in some ways, I'd always thought my first book might be a ghostwriting an autobiography, but that's, you know, just for whatever reason, that's not the way, not the way it panned out. And I just had real clarity about what I wanted this book to be. I wanted it to be a celebration of the Crucible as a venue, of the sport, and of the World Championship, all of which I love. I wanted it to be almost self-contained little stories. I wanted to pick the greatest matches so you could... You didn't have to read the whole book. You didn't even have to read it chronologically. You could sort of dip in and out, and each one was its own little story. So if we were meeting a player for the first time in the book, I could perhaps give it a bit of context, give them a bit of personal background, their career, what they'd done, and how they'd done in the tournament and the season, that sort of thing, before you actually came to the match itself. And I knew that's what I wanted to do. I knew that I wanted to speak to players about it and get their recollections from matches that, you know, some of them only a couple of years ago, but some of them, I think the earliest one in the book goes back to 1980. So, you know, we're talking about matches, you know, 37 years ago, and, you know, in some cases it's extraordinary, the sort of powers of recall of, yeah. of some of the players of shots and frames and such like.
Mm. Whenever, I mean, it's 20 matches, whenever anyone compiles a list, it's always tempting to see sort of what's not on it as much as what is on it, but you had to narrow it down. So what was the sort of criteria?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair question. I think, it, I mean, hopefully it isn't a sort of beauty contest in terms of the matches that are in and that are out. I do think it's a celebration of the sort of bigger stuff. That said, obviously you are picking a list. I personally would say that everyone who sort of loves and follows snooker would maybe, of what's in the book, perhaps 6, 7, 8, 9, everyone would pick.
Yeah.
And then over and above that, it becomes a little more subjective. And that can depend on just so many factors, sort of, you know, perhaps even down to things like who your favourite players are, yeah. the type of match you like, whether you, it has to be a dramatic sort of final frame finish, whether it, you know, whether it's a quality or errors and drama, whether it's, has to be a final or a first, can be a first round match. There's so many factors. So you do your best. As I think, you know, Barry Hearn was very, very kind to write the foreword of the, and as he said in there, it's a pub argument waiting to happen. And, I don't, as often the case, I don't think anyone could put it better.
Yeah. I remember when I was a kid, I got a Monty Python video and it was called Parrot Sketch Not Included. And literally it had all their greatest hits and they didn't put that on. And I was just wondering, at any point were you tempted not to include the 85 final? Of which a lot has been said.
Just to annoy people.
Yeah.
I think it might have got more publicity in the book if I hadn't. maybe that would have been the reverse psychology, thing to do. No, honestly, no. I knew that had to go in. I knew I had to speak to Steve and Dennis. And also, one thing I would say about that match, when you're talking to them, it's so hard to get genuinely new stuff out of it, because that, you know, that final has been covered, talked about, written about, spoken about to death, and to get anything sort of fresh on it is tricky. And I'm not sure, you know, they were both very kind to give me time and spoke to me at length about it. You know, a lot of it is perhaps stuff that's slightly gone over again, but, you know, it is not just probably the greatest snooker match at the Crucible, but just a huge, you know, in sport generally, it's a hugely iconic moment, and so it had to be there. And I think they've reflected on it, and as with all the chapters, it was a combination of their comments, their interviews, but also, you know, research, going back. I've spent a lot of time on YouTube and a lot of time poring over Chris Downer's Crucible Almanac.
Well, I was going to ask you, like, how did you go about, because it's quite detailed stuff in there. You also had to watch a lot of these matches, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think they were armed with the, once you've got your idea, you've got your plan, then I think everything sort of is slightly easier in terms of how you go forward. I mean, it's the same for anything in life, I'm sure. And so once I knew what I was going to do, I thought it was interviews. So it was getting the interviews was, you know, was a big thing. I mean, I had my list, and as you know, you'll have seen in the book, some players feature more than others. Yeah. So I think really it came, I thought I needed Steve Davis, Stephen Hendry, Ronnie O'Sullivan and Jimmy White as an absolute minimum. Mm. And if I thought I could get those four, then I thought I had a book, and then I could work towards, you know, getting everybody else. Actually, the last person I spoke to was Dennis Taylor, funnily enough, but I always was confident that he wouldn't mind speaking about the 1985
final. Enough, yeah. He'd been waiting for the call, I think.
So I wasn't, even though that was a missing one and it was a very important one, I wasn't too overly
that's
worried.
That's a banker.
Overly worried that he would speak to me. But once I had those four, and, you know, thank them again very much for their time, and because, you know, for all of them it was a 3, 4, 5 matches, I knew that I had what I wanted, and then it was, you know, as you say, supplementing those interviews with the, you know, going through a lot of YouTube footage, a lot of research, not just YouTube, things like some of the life stories from ITV, which I've always enjoyed. Some of these players were very good, contemporary. You know, I kept a lot of my own cuttings from the ones where I have been covering it, obviously not the older ones. Going back to those and going back to contemporary press conferences, a lot of which are filmed anyway. And putting it all together and then hopefully producing some kind of sort of self-contained story. That was very much the way I went about it.
Yeah, but this is, I think, like I said to you before we started, the great strength, I think, is the interviews, because it's not just a sort of run-through of matches. You're hearing from the people involved in them. You're hearing from the people who won them. You're hearing from the people who lost them. And it's fascinating, particularly, I think, the early ones. You know, as you say, the recall 30-odd years on, someone like Cliff Thorburn to hear about playing Alex Higgins in that final, to hear from people like Terry Griffiths and Joe Johnson, and as you mentioned, Stephen Dennis. How easy was it to get hold of these people? Because, I mean, we're talking the all-time legends of the game here. You know, Davis, Hendry, O'Sullivan, Jimmy White, Dennis, Terry, Cliff, and so on and so on. I mean, you've got a great collection of interviews.
It is, you know, I've got to be honest, it's the thing that I enjoy most about my job, you know, journalism. I enjoy interviewing, I think I'm quite good at it, I love doing it, so that wasn't, even though it's key to the book, it was by no means a hardship. I mean, I don't mind, you know, I'll always back myself to sort of hopefully ask some half-decent questions and get some, you know, reasonably hot, you know, new stuff out of people, and it was difficult, but I have to say, you know, people were so helpful, the players, and what you benefit from, as you know yourself, that a lot of these people are still involved at tournaments.
Yes.
They're there, whether it's as commentators, ambassadors, pundits, they are there. And I actually didn't do that many, having said that, I didn't do that many of the interviews at the tournaments, but I was able to sort of prime them, to just sort of say, I've got this book I'm doing for next year, would it be okay to have a chat to you? In some cases, you know, if I was talking to them for an hour and a half, we split it. So we did 45 minutes at one tournament about a couple of matches, and then 45 minutes about another couple of matches at another tournament. I certainly did that with Stephen Hendry. Cliff was a long and very expensive phone call to Canada. I think my wife wasn't too happy when that bill came through, but very enjoyable. Just incredible anecdotes, and, you know, he's just a great person to listen to talking about snooker. I think Jimmy White, when I phoned him, he was in a particularly good mood and was very happy to speak, and then he dropped in at the end. He was sitting on a yacht in Marbella at the time, which
but the thing is, but Jimmy, about everyone I guess you rang would have the most reason not to want to really reminisce, because obviously we know you're talking about matches basically that he lost, big finals that he lost.
I think the thing about Jimmy White, which I would imagine a lot of people feel, is I cannot believe how somebody who is come so close to winning the thing they wanted most, but fallen short. It's so free of sort of any bitterness and rancour. And I think you can only be the way he is if you genuinely, genuinely love the sport. Mm. Like, really, really love it. Not just say you love it, but really love it. Mm. And I think my respect for him was hugely enhanced with the contributions he made towards the book. You know, they were already pretty high, because he was my favourite player when I was a kid, and but he is able to overcome those disappointments about which he gets asked all the time, as you know, and still show that he loves the sport. And, the fact is, if you looked at his Crucible wins, I'm sure he's one of the most successful players in Crucible history in terms of matches won there. He just didn't quite win it. And as we know, he was up against, you know, arguably the greatest player of all time, and at his absolute peak, and that can happen in sport. But he was happy. I mean, I don't think it was that he wasn't happy talking about it. It's just Jimmy, you know, still is a bit of a ducker and a diver.
Yeah.
Sometimes he's difficult to sort of pin down.
Yeah.
Maybe even Eurosport have found over the years. But when he does speak, everyone listens because what comes out of his mouth is pure sense and real insight. And I found that as much for the contributions for the book as I'm sure Eurosport sort of viewers do when he's in the studio.
Yeah. Matthew Stevens as well is someone who's lost a couple of finals, lost some semi-finals, and you interviewed him, and I got the sense with him, there did seem to be a little bit of regret. I think because he was in the final against Mark Williams so young, I think you say this in the book, there was just an expectation, well, I've lost this final, but I'll be back next year and the year after and whatever, and it'll happen. But as we know, it hasn't happened for him there, and he's still playing, but, you know, he's got to qualify this year. Did you sense there was sort of, he's sort of looking back and thinking, actually, I've missed my chance here?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it's, you know, I think it's very appropriate that you bring that up straight after Jimmy White, because I think, as I say in the book, you know, he's probably another player that was very popular, and a lot of neutrals would have liked the style, the way he played the game. You know, very sort of fluent, very attacking game. A lot of people, I think, neutrals would have liked to have seen him win a world title, and obviously he had that incredible run. You know, this is the finals, but also in a lot of semi-finals, all in a relatively short space of time. You know, he was a contender every year for sort of, you know, whatever, sort of 8 years or so. And yeah, no, that was one of the more, you know, more poignant interviews. I'd agree with you. There was a bit of regret there. I think when you get to a final like he did in 2000, I think he just expected the chances to keep coming, and it just doesn't always happen that way. But I think he, as much as anyone, was very, very frank and very, very honest about that. You know, and it's, I think sometimes you ring players and it's nice to be remembered. You know, that obviously the match he features it in the book was the Sean Murphy match, not the final, but the one where Sean Murphy sort of did the huge comeback in the quarter final in 2007. And I think players at least like to know that they've registered, they're on the radar, that those matches they played in are still remembered, and that if you bother to sort of research it and call them about it, then they often will talk about it, even if it's painful. And you know, it's 10 years on, that, as you say, that clearly is still painful.
Yeah. Stephen Hendry obviously is going to feature strongly. I mean, he's been on this podcast, and what was interesting, I think it's the same in the book, but I spoke to him, is that he still genuinely regrets not beating Peter Ebdon in that final. That would have been, I mean, he already holds the record for 7, and everything else you think, Stephen, you know, you've done okay. But it rankles with him still.
It really did, and I was quite surprised about that. And I think the two matches where he said that were still really, he was talking in the, was it a loss to Steve James, was it? Was another one?
And 91, when he was first time champion. Yeah.
And that one really annoyed him as well. In fact, he was visibly bridling talking about it when he was talking about that Steve James match, and you know, that's 1991. I mean, it's and Peter Ebdon one was the same. I think, you know, it's far be it for me to say that he didn't respect him enough. I don't think that's necessarily the case, but he thought he was going to win,
yeah.
And he thought he was going to win even when he was training, and he got back to, I think, 12 all in that match, and then he was absolutely certain he was going to win.
It's like he'd had his final against O'Sullivan, because that was obviously a grudge match at the time. Ronnie had said the things that he said, which weren't very friendly, and there was, I think, the feeling, maybe even subconsciously with Hendry, was, well, I've won it now, I've just got to get through the next 2 days and that's it.
Yeah, and he's honest about that. He pretty much says that in that chapter in the book. It was a huge match, the Ronnie O'Sullivan semi-final. That was their second semi-final in a couple of years, wasn't it, that Hendry had won before the one he went on to sort of lose quite convincingly. But I think he was, if not quite sort of spent, he was, it had taken a lot out of him, and there had been a lot of controversy over some of the comments sort of Ronnie O'Sullivan had made before the semi-final about, you know, I think he said something about sending him back to his sad little life in Scotland, and that they didn't sort of like sort of socialising Steve Hendry and things like that. And you know, he'd got a lot of press coverage, a lot of media coverage at the time, and those, you know, mentally these things can be quite draining. And you go from that into a really another grudge match, because there wasn't any love lost between Steve Hendry and Peter Ebdon at that time. So you're two in a row over, you know, 5 days. Against, as we know, one of the most durable, sort of determined opponents that we've ever seen in snooker. And I think Hendry needed to win it quick, and when he didn't win it quick, and it was close at the end, I think he was always going to be difficult. And the quotes from Peter Ebdon, I think, in that chapter are also brilliant. I mean, the quotes don't necessarily correspond to perhaps the level of the match. You know, when you're going through the book, sometimes the quotes on a particular match are just brilliant. And Peter Ebdon's quotes about that final were really memorable. You know, he described Stephen Hendry as the biggest, baddest, great white shark snooker's ever seen, sort of, so, you know, so sort of ruthless and menacing, and he was determined. They'd had a couple of run-ins in previous tournaments. I think one where he'd shouted out at the Masters before he'd actually won the match, which really irked Hendry. He never forgot that. And I don't think Stephen Hendry was the biggest fan of his ponytail at the World Championship and all sorts. It obviously there were some things that they didn't quite see eye to eye on. And it was no quarter given, and Ebden sort of stood up to it. He went toe to toe with him and ended up winning. And it was a hugely painful defeat for Stephen Hendry, as you say, deprived him of the King Henry VIII headlines that we were all desperate to write at the time. And also a massive, massive win for Ebden, having lost out a couple of times.
Well, of course, but he features again later on in the infamous match with Ronnie O'Sullivan when he's 8-2 down and goes into grinding mode and Ronnie completely falls apart. And I was interested to read both their quotes on that, particularly Ebden, though, because he remains unrepentant, doesn't he? He doesn't say, yeah, that was my tactic. He says, no, I was just playing my game. But he doesn't sort of in any way back down from what he said at the time.
Yeah, I think that is one of my favourite matches in the book. Not just in the book, just generally at the Crucible. I was there covering it. It was incredible. I think Ronnie was he 8-2 up?
Yeah.
In that match, and then remorselessly, sort of Peter Ebden sort of slowed it right down, refused to give in. You know, the two, I think, most memorable moments were the. Was it 3 minutes over a shot, and then a break that took a break of 12 that took more time than Ronnie had taken for his 147 against Mick Price. It caused huge controversy at the time. Was it that Peter Ebden was locked in his sort of bubble and intensity and just trying his hardest and just wasn't really conscious of how fast or slow he was playing, or was it that he was doing it deliberately? And in such a manner that perhaps was beyond the rules, and he should have been really hauled up by the referee, Colin Brindley, who sadly no longer with us. And that was the debate, and it was a debate that was immediately sort of held in the BBC studio when he went in there afterwards by Hazel Irvine and others. And I think Peter Ebden was stunned. I think he was genuinely shocked. He thought he was going to walk in there and everyone was going to pat him on the back and say, "What an amazing comeback! That's one of the greatest wins we've ever seen here." And he was genuinely stunned and shocked when the questions that were coming his way were sort of emails from viewers sort of saying, "This is appalling, you should be thrown out of the tournament." And I think the quotes from Ronnie O'Sullivan, as you say, were also very, very strong in that chapter. And he says it was his worst moment in snooker, I think, along with the Grand Dot semi-final when he had having all the problems with his tip and stuff. And he describes in excruciating detail the agonies he was going through watching it. And it's just great. Hopefully it's great to read because it was an extraordinary match. And then of course, it went on for months because, Peter Ebden ended up suing or attempting to sue, Matthew Syed in the Times for effectively calling him a cheat. But as a columnist, he obviously has a duty to have an opinion rather than just report the facts, and it went to arbitration, binding arbitration, and it was found against Ebden and for the Times and Matthew Syed. So that was another sort of sour taste that was left with Peter Ebden, that he tried to sort of redress that and correct what he saw as an unfair portrayal and wasn't successful in that.
Yeah, I think this is the thing though about the Crucible and the World Championship. Had that happened at another tournament, we probably would have forgotten about it by now. We just sort of vaguely remember it, but it's still, these memories are still raw, and they're still raw for the players involved, aren't they?
Yep, it's the biggest, best, last tournament of the season. As more than one player says in the book, what happens at the Crucible can make or ruin your summer. Or your season, actually, in a lot of cases in the past. I think particularly when it was when the rankings were less fluid and your ranking was for the whole year. If you were a good Crucible player, like say Matthew Stevens, you could pretty much safeguard your top 16 spots, and it was really important, and you could do that at the Crucible. When there were fewer tournaments, less ranking points to play for, and the relative strength of those points was much bigger, obviously, at Sheffield with the lesser number of tournaments, and it was it could absolutely make or break your summer, and I think that is one of the reasons why the memories are so strong.
Talk about Ronnie O'Sullivan, who features in quite a few of these matches. He's not been very expansive in media interviews in general of late, but thankfully he was with you. And one of the most interesting chapters I found was the match. It wasn't a close match. It's the one where he destroyed Hendry in the semis, 17-4, I think it was. And there was a great quote in there. He was saying about Hendry, and he didn't mean it in a nasty way at all, because he was very repentant about the things he'd said before about it. But he said, when you're a bully, you don't like being bullied back. And it's true, isn't it? You know, I mean, he had to have that mindset that he couldn't afford to have any sympathy at all for Stephen Hendry that day.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that match, I would, if there were people out there who said maybe that one shouldn't be in there, that's fair enough. I would accept that point of view, because you had the three semi-finals with Ronnie O'Sullivan and Stephen Hendry, the 99 one, the 2002 one, and the 2004 one, sort of all pretty closely grouped together. And I didn't really want to have all three of them, so I kind of decided I wanted to leave one of them out, and in the end I left the 2002 one out, but it could easily have been either of the other two. And I sort of slightly make the analogy in the, I think that quote, with each chapter I've used a sort of a quote at the beginning of the chapter, which hopefully captures perhaps some essence of that match, or a USP of it, and I've used that quote at the beginning of that chapter about the, bullies don't like to be bullied. And I just think it was the analogy that I've used in the book is that it's a little bit like if you go to Cheltenham and, you want to watch one of the great horses and you don't want to see it close, you want to see them run their absolute best and fastest and destroy the opposition and be what they are. And I very much saw that semi-final in that context. I thought Ronnie O'Sullivan was like a thoroughbred who was just absolutely destroying the opposition. And, we weren't talking about some mug here. We were talking about, seven-time world champion, greatest player ever, king of the Crucible. And he made him look ordinary. And for that reason alone, I thought it was an extraordinary match. I don't think Hendry felt too bad about it, in that things had changed. Say 1999, he knew that he expected to win. I think by 2004 he didn't expect to win the World Championship. He hoped he would, but he wasn't expecting to. Ronnie O'Sullivan was a proven World Champion. He'd obviously won it in 2001. The balance of power had hugely shifted in a few years, and so it wasn't a total surprise, but it was an example of a ruthless sort of demolition of a great player, and memorable for that, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. I think Stephen Hendry and a lot of players can accept being outplayed. You can say, okay, I was just outplayed. It's different to losing to Everton in a decider where he feels he should have won. He was just sort of destroyed, and he's done that to people, and he accepts that Ronnie O'Sullivan can do it. But talking in general about Ronnie, sometimes Ronnie sort of gives the impression that, he's not that interested in records and not that interested in looking back. But actually I got the sense that he did enjoy reminiscing about his sort of Crucible moments, even the ones that didn't go so well.
Yeah, I think he did. He necessarily agreed with all of my choice of matches that I'd picked of his to go in there. But he was brilliant. And as you said, as with everyone, I was very grateful for his time. But I think that was actually in the UK, very enjoyable sort of hour and a half over breakfast in York. And luckily before one or two of the recent sort of media issues, which I understand sort of. There's always issues with the media now and again, but I was very grateful to him for his time on that one. And he did enjoy talking about it. I think he really enjoyed talking about the Peter Ebden match we've discussed, and sort of some of the other ones. I think the last one, the most recent one in the book, was the Neil Robertson one in 2012, which a lot of people saw as possibly the real final. We know it was a quarter final, and that one I picked because the sort of Steve Peters factor. I mean, Ronnie's career was, great player as we know he is, his career was in trouble at that time. He hadn't won a ranking title for 2.5 years before that amazing win at the German Masters, where he was, I think, 4-0 down in the first round to Higginson, ended up winning 5-4. And that changed everything in him, because he saw that the work he'd been doing with Steve Peters for a few months was actually working. It could translate to winning silverware, trophies, and it completely turned his career around. It effectively gave him a second career, I think. But he still, even though he'd won in Berlin, he still wasn't sure whether it was going to work over 17 days on the biggest stage at the World Championship, the Crucible Theatre in Sheffield. And I think that match against Robertson was huge in that regard. I think it made him think. And Neil Robertson was a real contender for the world title that year. He really thought he was going to win a second world title. He was sure of it. He thought he'd beat Ronnie, and he thought he'd win the world title. And you know, Ronnie had to play pretty near his absolute best in that game, which is why I picked it, because I thought that was a really good match. But also the extra significance of the Steve Peters factor and the belief it had given him that he could go on and have a sort of second career. And when you look at what's happened since, he has. I mean, he obviously won that world title, he's won another one, more Masters titles, other titles. And we might not have had that had it. You know, let's give credit to Django Fung, Ronnie's former manager. I think he was very persistent trying to get him to speak to Steve Peters, and it was rejected, that advice, for a long time. But without that, I'm not sure we would have seen some of the brilliance in the last 5 years that we have seen.
This is, again, I think, one of the strengths of the book. You hear these little stories, you know, so-and-so persuaded me to speak to him. And also, you mentioned Neil Robertson. There's a chapter on his match with Martin Gould, and he's talking about... I love the little bit where he says, you know, he checked out his apartment, but he asked to keep his luggage in there just so he could come and sort of pick it up, because he expected to be on the way home, didn't he? And Martin as well, good sport for talking about it, because I'm sure when you rang up, he knew what you were going to ask about, and writing a book about the Crucible, great matches, he knows he's in there. I guess the only thing you can say from his point of view, at least he's been part of something special. Okay, it's finished the wrong way for him, but he was part of an extraordinary match there. And also, you make the point that it's right, it wasn't just about the play that day, it was about what had happened with Steve Davis and John Higgins, because they've seen Davis beat Higgins, and they know they're going to be a big favourite to beat Steve in the quarters, so they're playing almost for place in the semis.
That's right. No, I mean, that was the timings of those two, those two last 16 matches made that the case, that you'd have this amazing sort of event with Steve Davis beating John Higgins. I think it was a Saturday afternoon. I haven't got it in front of me, but...
Well, it was the morning. They were in the morning, and then Neil and Martin were on the afternoon.
Yeah, that's
right. And Martin tried to avoid the score, but someone told him.
Someone told him, that's right, yeah, because he said also that day he was trying to avoid the Tottenham Man United score. He's a big Tottenham fan, but someone told him Tottenham had lost to Manchester United as well, so he wasn't doing too well on the not being told the score front. But, no, you're absolutely right. There is a subplot. Both players mention it. The subplot to that was that whoever won was going to be playing a 52-year-old, albeit six-time world champion and complete legend of the sport, but they had a match against Steve Davis for a place in the semi-finals. And, you know, without in any way disrespecting Steve Davis, both of them would have fancied that job, no question about it, at that particular time, as long as they sort of perhaps didn't make one or two of the mistakes that John Higgins made in that game. But I think, interesting, Neil Robertson was delighted, because he thought it put more pressure on Martin Gould. He thought that Martin Gould, having not been in that position before, might feel that pressure a little more than he would about potentially playing sort of Steve Davis for a place in the semi-finals. And, you know, I think without you know, we'll never know 100%. And I think the thing that I remember about that match is just how well Martin Gould played at the beginning. He was absolutely brilliant. He played superbly in that match for sort of two sessions. You know, I mean, Neil Robertson, you know, in the book sort of says that he was almost like he had the soul of Ronnie O'Sullivan, and that if Ronnie O'Sullivan had been playing that well, everyone would have been waxing lyrical about it. And he was that good. You know, I think Martin Gould is someone who craves a stage. He loves, he says he's a private person off the table, and I think that's true, but on the table, I think he loves a crowd, he loves an arena. You know, no surprise to me that he won the German Masters in that amazing Tempodrome Arena, which, you know, I know you've been to and I've been to, and it's an incredible place on a on the one table to play snooker in front of 2,500 people. So there's no surprise to me that, you know, Martin Gould shone on that stage. And I think it's the same. If you give him a chance and he's up for it, you know, he's capable of that. But that's your classic sort of comeback. That's one of the elements of a great match, I think. A huge favourite against a big underdog and a comeback. Two strikes, two big elements in a great match. And that, you know, that is one that I think most people who watch won't forget in a hurry.
I was interested. Gould seemed to suggest that when he got on the practice table, even before the last session, he said he was struggling even then, which suggests there's something psychological about, because you don't get it in any other tournament, being ahead overnight. And you must go to bed thinking, on the one hand, great, you know, I need two frames to win, and on the other hand, what if it goes wrong? I'll never get over it. And we saw that, of course, Paul Hunter Ken Doherty match as well, but Paul's 15-9 up coming into the last afternoon, and of course it turns around and Ken wins.
Yeah, it's so big, you can have too long to think about it, I'm sure. And as you say, maybe you're better off playing morning and evening the same day, but having the night to think about it, perhaps not getting a good night's sleep. You say his quotes were strong on that. He I think he said when he went into the practice room just before the final session, it was almost like his arm sort of wasn't there or didn't belong to him, and he had a very bad sort of feeling and premonition about what was about to happen. And you know, sadly for Martin, that proved to be the case. And you know, Neil Robertson, once he got to within a couple of frames, he thought he had him. And he's, when he gets on a roll, as we know, he's a very, very difficult player to stop.
Judd Trump is a lot of people's pick this year. He's having a great season, as we know. And he features in the semi-final. Well, he features twice, semi-final and the final in 2011. But you've said about when he beat Ding in the semis that year he was carefree, you know, he was enjoying it, he was expecting to beat everybody. But he also said that he's not been like that since, because, of course, now he's become a player people are expecting to win, and certainly this year a lot of people are tipping him. I was interested that he was saying that he does feel the nerves there, and I thought it was good of him to admit that, because they must all do. I mean, it's such a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, that year was it was a great semi-final, it was a great final, it was for Trump, it was a great 6 weeks, you know, with what he did in, you know, his breakthrough title at the China Open. And I do believe, and hopefully it's the way I've written the book, but I do believe context is important in these things. I think, you know, before you actually get to the, you know, who pots which balls in a match, you sort of look at whether it's the season or there are key moments that provide, you know, appropriate and fitting context for these things. And, you know, with Judd Trump that year in 2011, it was winning the China Open. I think he'd struggled in qualifying. He's a big stage, you know, big atmosphere player. He struggled, as Ding had, to be fair, in his early career, with the sort of cubicles and the qualifying, and it just wasn't his thing, you know, and he wasn't playing his best there. And then on a very rare occasion where he managed to get out of that and get onto the big stage, the pressure was so great, because he wasn't doing it that often, that sometimes it all got too much for him, and he didn't shine. So that win in China, just before the 2011 World Championship, was absolutely huge for Judd Trump. And it gave him that confidence, and he just surfed that wave of confidence, as we know, all the way through that tournament. I think it was Neil Robertson, wasn't it, he beat in the first round, which is obviously defending champion. That was a big win. And then Ding, the quotes that I like about that particular chapter were about his relationship with Ding and the way he saw him as a
almost
rival.
Like a sort of, almost like a grudge match, in a way.
Very much so. And that wasn't something that I particularly sort of stirred up or probed, although, you know, I admit to occasionally being guilty of that in the past in my job. I didn't fish for that in any way. It was very genuine, and it came out completely unprompted. It's that he said, you know, he was obviously a couple of years behind Ding. He'd seen Ding win big, win young, and he wanted a bit of that action. And he you know, he had something to prove. I think he was a little bit of maybe sort of China's number one, and he felt he was the sort of, you know, perhaps the heir apparent in the UK. And there was definitely a lot on it for Judd Trump. He's very honest about that in that chapter, that it wasn't just, you know, it was two young players. And you never know, you know, as we've seen, you know, we've already talked about it, you never know when the chance is going to come along. You know, you might get other chances, or it might be that is your chance, you know, when you look back in 20 years' time, and you had to grab it. And I think both of them were quite aware of that. But despite that, they shrugged the pressure off, and it was one of the most, I think, sort of joyous matches that I can remember watching at the Crucible in a latter stage. They both of them just absolutely went for it. They both played incredibly well. It was a real toe-to-toe, you know, toe-to-toe match, and just thoroughly enjoyable for them and both players, you know, for both players and the audience, and, you know, anyone who was involved. But no, you're right. He has, I think, since slightly curbed some of those attack instincts. Not completely, and I don't think he ever should. But to win titles, occasionally you do just have to add things to your game, and I think Judd Trump has done that. I think he has added things to his game, and, you know, this year you only have to look at the sort of bookmakers' odds, and, you know, as we speak, the China Open's yet to conclude, but you know, I just was doing some stats this morning that, you know, reaching the quarterfinals of the China Open, he'd won 9 matches in a row, 21 out of 23, just coming off winning the Players' Championship. He's right up there in the betting for the World Championship with Mark Selby and Ronnie O'Sullivan, with people like sort of John Higgins and Ding just behind. You know, he is a serious contender for a first world title this year, and I think that is as a result of making the little changes that your question was about.
So let's look ahead then to this year's World Championship. It's going to be special. It's the 40th anniversary of the Crucible. It's actually the 90th anniversary of the World Championship itself, because it started in 1927. I mean, are you ready for it? Because it's a long haul, isn't it? You know, you're there all day, every day, and it doesn't just start on the first day. You've got all the previews, you've got the qualifying. It's a big commitment.
I think for someone who's a journalist, and particularly if you're a journalist covering it for more than one paper, yeah, it's a big deal. I mean, really, my Crucible probably starts at least 3 weeks before it kicks off, and that's in the sort of accumulation of stories. I want stories that I can use perhaps on a quiet day's play. You know, sometimes the live play takes care of itself and they're great stories, but it's good to go there with quite a few up your sleeve, and as you say, all the nice previews as well. So I've been busy sort of dealing with that, you know, the last few days really. I will be going up. I won't be there for the whole of the qualifiers, but I always go up for that last day, the judgment day, because that Wednesday is almost a sporting event in itself. Sort of pressure and attention is incredible to witness, and the emotions of the players sort of coming off, win or lose, whether they've made it to the Crucible, you know, sometimes for the first time as a debutant, or they're an experienced former world champion who's you know, missed out and they're absolutely devastated. Is quite something to behold, and I think this new qualifying system of the, you know, even everyone from world number 17 downwards having to play the three matches has only intensified it. Yeah. I have to say, the last couple of years I've been up there that day, I think it's made it from their point of view worse, or more pressurised. I think it gives perhaps the lower rank players a bit more of a chance, but for the, you know, the guys. Now, it was impressive last year. It was a bit of an exception where Dean breezed through qualifying and ended up sort of having a very, very, you know, best ever run at the Crucible. But I think that's the exception rather than the rule these days. Mm. It's a tough old school to get through, and great for drama, great to report on, but really tough on the players.
Yeah, very much so. But I'd like to say great drama for snooker fans. And it's like a sort of mini world championship in itself. There's no one winner, but there is a prize at the end of it, and that's, of course, to get to the Crucible. Let's just talk. You said that the first one you covered in full was 2004. So that's, what, 13 years ago. In that time, the media landscape has changed, hasn't it? Just talk about that, because, as you say, you no longer have so many newspaper journalists there. There's a lot of people doing online stuff. There's increasingly people from China come over. But it has changed, hasn't it?
Yeah, no, it really has changed. I mean, there's a hard core. You obviously have a sort of the domestic radio, there's a good presence. So the BBC, people like George Riley, Jamie Broughton there. The presence of written UK journalists has very much gone down over that time, which is a shame. And you know, it's a battle to get it into the papers, and there's lots of reasons for that. I think some editors were sort of inclined against snooker, which is a real shame. But you know, what do? You give up or you keep fighting the fight? I mean, if I got demoralised about having snooker ideas rejected by editors, I'd have jumped into the nearby Thames by now a long time ago. Because it can be difficult, but hopefully you keep knocking on the door, you do get the courage. At least you know at the World Championship there is a residual interest, and they will at least cover that properly. But if, as you say, I think probably those missing people, if you like, have been replaced by other people, a big contingent from China, but not just China. You know from your work in Eurosport how popular it is across the continent, and you know there are people there from a lot of Eastern European countries now as well, journalists, and that's great. You know, that's very positive, and it's fun. It's nice to spend time with those people and try and get to as many of those countries as possible. Sometimes, you know, can be difficult, but you know, there are places where there are ranking events or, you know, former PTCs that I would still love to go to. Romania is definitely one of them, just to sort of see and try and get those features. And the good thing about the qualifiers is you've always got new things. I mean, we were talking before we started sort of recording the interview about sort of Hossein Vafai from Iran. I mean, he's someone who interests me. I would love to, you know, write something about him. Hopefully he could win his first qualifying match. As you say, the online side of it has burgeoned. I think maybe as a beat reporter on snooker, your role has changed, because if you had the contacts and you had all the contacts with players and referees, then you were the only person who got the stories. Now a lot of the people that you spoke to have got social media.
Yeah.
They put it straight out there themselves. So I think to get something new and exclusive, is not impossible, but it's probably more difficult these days than it used to be.
Yeah, I was going to say, because that's the relationship between newspaper journalists and the online guys. I think, and it's often not their fault, they just don't know, but they think that if someone says something, they just put it out into the ether. But quite often you guys in the newspapers, you need like a story for the next day that isn't just so-and-so, it's so-and-so. And you don't want it like on the internet within seconds.
Yeah, I mean, I think, listen, I have it in football as well, where, you know, I went to the Belgium-Greece game last week, and I was interviewing players, like, you know, in the mix zone, and sometimes you get hold of the player, you ask all the questions, and someone will lean over from behind you, record it all, and put it all straight out online when you were planning it for the paper. And, you know, you have to be aware of those sort of things. I think a lot of the online people are respectful anyway. I think if you sort of say, look, you know, perhaps we've asked these questions, but we've asked it for a reason. We know there's a quiet day in a couple of days. Is that okay if we just hang on to that till? That, you know, I think most people realise why, and then are very happy to play ball on that. It might be the odd person who comes in for the first time who perhaps doesn't sort of quite understand that. But you know, this is as you quite correctly say, the nature of sort of reporting and the news that's out there has changed, and you know, it's quite difficult to hang on to stuff because it's about now, isn't it? And this stuff is out there straight away, and so it's probably slightly more difficult to do that.
And also, so much happens on Twitter now. I mean, last year there was that bust up with Trump and Dominic Dale, which is just like a Twitter thing. And I guess you have to sort of monitor that as well. You have to be aware of what people are saying in there, because obviously the general public are reading it, and they know things are happening.
The general public are reading it, and you know, people who could supply it to newspapers are reading it. So that's probably one of the more grudging aspects of my job. I do have to monitor Twitter all the time, and if I'm completely honest, I'd rather not, but I don't have a choice, because it's a medium, it's a good medium. Players are good on there, they say, you know, get things off their chest, and they're very frank on there, and so, listen, if you're, trying to do a professional job, you absolutely have to keep an eye on Twitter and sort of Facebook and some of the other stuff, but, in a way, I'd rather be speaking to people direct, but I think that's one of the obvious ways things have evolved.
Yeah, and didn't have all this in 1977 when they first went to the Crucible. Finally, then, I'll ask you straight out, who's going to win it?
Well, I think it's between. I'd like to see a Mark Selby Judd Trump final, and I think it might be Trump's year this year.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you could make a case for so many. It's like an Agatha Christie play, isn't it? There's so many people who could end up holding the trophy. It's going to be fascinating, as the book was. Congratulations again on the book. I'm sure snooker fans will really enjoy it, and it's great. I think it's just great to go back. It's not just nostalgia for the sake of it. It's actually detailed, and as I say, the accounts of the players adding sort of modern context to it. Because there are a lot of people listening to this who won't remember, they won't have been alive when some of these matches were played.
That's right.
But it's all part of the tapestry of the tournament, isn't it? And that continuity of being at the Crucible as well. All this has happened at the same venue.
Yeah, I mean, I did take the sort of opportunity to devote chapter one to, you know, an account of how the Crucible came to be chosen, because we've all enjoyed it, and I think we all enjoy it, you know, probably owe a little bit of a debt to Mike Watson former promoter for finding it, and I think it explains very clearly how it came about, and it was almost by accident with his wife sort of Carol stumbling across it, you know, visiting the theatre to see a theatre production, and I think that really hopefully sets the tone for the rest of the book. It is, you know, as I said earlier, I think it hopefully is a celebration of the venue, the sport, and the World Championship, and even if perhaps matches that you would have loved to be there aren't in there, then hopefully you'll sort of get that out of it. And I look forward to. I think it's going to be on sale in the Crucible. I might even do a little Crucible only discount, because the book's launched on April the 14th, the day before it all kicks off. Yes, if you're up there, then come to the merchandise store, and there'll be copies there.
Well, listen, there's one answer to matches not being in it. Volume 2. That's got to be it, because, well, I hope it does, Hector, and thanks a lot for being on the podcast.
That's been a real pleasure. Thanks, Dave.
Cheers. Thank you for listening to the Snooker Scene podcast. Just to say, this is the last podcast until after the World Championship. Obviously, it's a very busy period coming up with the qualifiers and the Crucible itself, but I'll be back literally on the night of the final, after it's all over, to review the 17 days. So I hope that wherever you're watching the World Championship, whether you go to Sheffield, whether you watch it on the BBC, on Eurosport, wherever, do enjoy it, and I'll see you after it's all done and dusted.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.